Informed Dissent, the intersection of healthcare and politics, with Dr. Jeff Barkey, board-certified primary care physician, and Dr. Mark McDonald, board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist.
All right. Mark, welcome back to another great episode of Informed Dissent. Great to be with you.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
So we're ready to roll here, and we've got a great guest. You know, of course, Mark, you and I have talked over the last several years about our evolution, really, of medical care from what we were trained in medical school about to our awakening, especially during COVID, how much of what we learned was incorrect. And now we're having to relearn a lot of things about holistic health and supplements and nutrition, how to take care of our bodies and so forth, and get away from the disease state pharma model of healthcare. So one of our colleagues who kind of has done the same thing, and I've been following him for a while, is Dr. Brian Thornburg, and he's out of Florida. He's a board certified pediatrician. So Brian, welcome to Informed Dissent.
Well, thank you very much, Mark and Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Brian. Yeah,
great to have you with us. So as I understand it, you're a pediatrician and you've kind of had a similar evolution in your thinking as well. Tell us about that.
Yes, I'm a board certified pediatrician. I've been practicing since 2003. I finished residency in 2003. And I came out of my training, probably like most pediatricians, believing that that vaccines and antibiotics and the disease model was the best way to approach medicine. And, you know, there's been many different types of healthcare systems over the millennia. And this one, obviously, this form, this allopathic form, this medical MD form of medicine has been absolutely incredible in addressing some acute health issues. But now that we've kind of reached kind of the middle age of medicine, I think you could say that we're realizing that it doesn't address the whole body and we're not just parts of the body. So I was very much interested in holistic medicine before medical school. Since I was a child, I always wanted to be a doctor. I know a lot of doctors say that, but my perspective of doctor, looking back, was more shamanistic in that I wanted to integrate a person into their community inside of their family. And that was my understanding of what a medical doctor was at the age of 4 or 5 years old. And obviously, as I went through training and I saw the medical model, I changed my perspective of—I didn't really change my perspective. I kind of saw the shortcomings of that style of practice, and so while I was in residency, I was opened up an integrative healthcare practice and started working with a lot of my attendings and other medical students and people in the community. And then, as my senior thesis for residency, I did how was I sitting in an MD program as an osteopathic physician when 20, 30 years earlier, the American Medical Association would have taken away the licenses of those MDs for having me as a DO in their program. And so there was, I presented the differences between the two schools of medicine. And so when I first came out of residency, to loop that back around, I very much was a believer in vaccines. I just saw the integrative side as well. And then I started having some very intelligent parents, moms, dads, present me literature. And I looked at these moms and dads, said, "You guys are very, very intelligent people. Why are you having such an unscientific perspective?" And read what they had to give me. And I started to have some cracks in what I thought was a very strong foundation of understanding vaccines. And I started to work with parents in delaying vaccines. And that just grew. In 2006, I wrote my first paper on vaccines called A Global Vaccine Perspective. I wanted to understand how the U.S. policy differed from other Western and industrialized countries around the world and how the ACIP worked. And that's the body that approves the vaccines that we use in this country. At that time, it was very different than it is now. At that time, it was all closed door meetings. Since then, they've opened up their doors, and their meetings are now recorded and found on YouTube. So it's been a gradual transition, always having to have that hard wiring, but it really took parents to help me usher in that next evolution of understanding on vaccines.
So the ACIP is an advisory body to the FDA, and then the FDA ultimately takes their advice, which they always do. And I'm not sure I can think of any time where the ACIP made a recommendation to not approve a vaccine. Can you?
not since I've been studying. I think that they'll pose when I've listened to a lot of their minutes, and quite frankly, the science that the critical thinking that they're using to evaluate these research studies is somewhat lacking. I mean, it's quite clear when you look at some of the p-values and some of the very basics of statistics that they're kind of overlooking these areas which would prove that the vaccines were statistically safe. And I just recently did a series on the new RSV vaccine for newborns, and I was highlighting that. But yeah, I've never seen a vaccine, but I haven't really gone back to every single recording, so I can't say with certainty that every vaccine that's been presented to the ACIP has been approved. But I would off the cuff agree with you.
And that, you know, interesting too, when you look at the members of the ACIP, almost all of them are conflicted in some way.
Yes.
Either they're receiving grants from a pharmaceutical company to help do research, they're part of a National Institutes of Health study and so forth. And so it's hard to take their perspective seriously. So you've had this evolution, as I have, on vaccines. I've got two grown children, both of whom were fully vaccinated as children for the childhood vaccine schedule. And it was only after I went through this whole COVID nonsense that I also was awoken, a little bit before that, where I had patients similar to you bring me studies and show me vaccine injured people and had me actually read the package insert, which I thought was kind of ludicrous. You know, at 8-point font, I trusted the FDA and the CDC, so I didn't really bother to read those. Now I read them routinely, and I've come to learn that the whole vaccine industrial complex is corrupt. If you know nothing else about vaccines, for those that are listening to this podcast, knowing that the vaccine companies are immune from liability is really all you need to know to have a big red flag raised. Because if a company is immune from any liability for a product that they are selling to make a profit on, what incentive exactly do they actually have to make sure and make damn sure that their product is both safe and effective? If you had a car manufacturer that had no liability, do you think they'd care if their airbags or brakes didn't work perfectly well? And we've seen example after example of, you know, high quality companies that have had to recall cars because there's something faulty in the manufacturing process and so forth. But the vaccine companies, they don't care. I mean, I think there's individuals in there that are ethical, honest people that care, but the company at large, they don't care. And that's why 1986 or whenever it was that the PREP Act was passed, giving them immunity from liability, that we saw a skyrocketing in the number of vaccines recommended. And the, you know, I'm a family doc. I see kids as well. But the whole sham of well child checks was created to mimic the childhood vaccine schedules. I tell my patients, my moms with newborns, I have several now, there's nothing, I don't have any special knowledge for you to come in at 2 months, 4 months, 8 months, 12 months, you know, 18 months. For me to tell you that your kid is healthy, you're requested to come in at those intervals because that's when we want to vaccinate you. That's when I can charge you for an office visit. That's when I can make money selling you the vaccine and billing the insurance company. That's the reason. I don't need to see you at those intervals. Now, in California, it's different. Parents don't have the option to opt out of vaccines, either for medical reasons or for religious reasons, if they want to attend a public or private school. The only exception is homeschooling. I think that's different in Florida. It's different in almost every other state of the country, except California. What now are you doing as you educate patients and newborns that come in, moms with newborns that come in, about the childhood vaccine schedule? How are you handling that?
I'm one of the few pediatricians in my area that accepts patients who either delay or postpone vaccines. And when they come in for a meet and greet before they have their baby, I will explain vaccines. They usually come to me with that question in mind because they, as parents, want to do the best thing for their babies. They always want to start with very organic foods and do breastfeeding, and the vaccines come up as part of that list of how am I going to keep my baby in the best shape that they possibly can be. And I'll explain that vaccines, I've explained that global vaccine perspective where other industrialized countries, for example, in Europe, that 70 to 80% of them do not mandate vaccines, and that your child, if you were a resident of one of those 70 to 80 percent of those countries in Europe, they can go to school without a religious exemption or a medical exemption. The school doesn't ask, the county or whatever their health department is in those countries don't ask for a vaccine record. So those children can just go to school. Whereas here they're mandated and we have to take those vaccines. So I explained that there's different cultures have different interpretations of the scientific literature, and that through that combination of science and culture, we create what is medicine. And so different countries have different perspectives on the vaccines. So when I tell parents that, they can understand that their perspective may not be way off. It may be different than what's happening here in the United States, but it's, you know, may be more in line with what's happening in the majority of Europe. And then I break down the vaccines individually once I move past that philosophical discussion. I'll say I divide vaccines during that first, second year of life into three categories. I do asteroids hitting the Earth, plane crashes, and car crashes. Asteroids hitting the Earth. Asteroids have hit the Earth at some point in the past, but we don't stare up at the sky every day wondering if we're going to get hit today with an asteroid, but it is possible that it's going to happen. And here in the United States, we've not had a natural case of polio since 1979. So I tell the parent, it is possible that your child might be the first true polio unfortunate recipient of since in the last 40 some years, but I doubt it. So that's why it's an asteroid. Also, hepatitis B is an asteroid because unless mom has hepatitis B or is involved in a relationship where they would be in a high risk group, that child is not going to contract hepatitis B anytime soon as a newborn until, you know, they're at some age of consenting to do something bad. For the most part, I mean, there's some really rare conditions where a child can get hepatitis B. So I explained those are the asteroids, and they can change groupings once they get older. For instance, once a child can have sex, then hepatitis B is going to jump groups. So they would move out of the asteroid group and into a car crash group or possibly a plane crash group. And then my plane crashes are the meningitis shots during the Prevnar Hib during the first couple of years of life. You know, people don't walk away from plane crashes very bad. Very few people do walk away after plane crash, but most people don't. And if your child contracts meningitis, there's a 50% chance that there's going to be a lifelong neurological problem to possibly death. So that's why I classify that as a very high risk, very small chance. So that's why I put that in the airplane group. And then the car crashes happen every day, all day long. Almost everybody walks away from their car crash. Some people don't. And that's going to be your DTaP shot. That's going to be your rotavirus. So I classify that. And then when parents want to start to select which vaccines, it makes it easier for them with that schema to say, well, I want to do the, most people pick the plane crashes if they want to start early. And we'll work in that fashion. Then I'll tell them about the fact that the brain isn't fully matured in the blood-brain barrier, that the kidneys aren't fully matured until the age of 2, and that there's some detoxification issues. And by taking the vaccines, you're 100% taking the toxins that are in the vaccines for a maybe illness that's really very small chance of one of those illnesses actually happening. And so that kind of gives the patients a perspective on my view of vaccine. I also tell them I'm not going to recommend a different schedule. I said, this is the time for you to do your homework. Because we want you to be as educated and certain on your decision if you're going to vaccinate or not vaccinate, because adverse events are possible on either side of that equation. If you don't vaccinate, there could be a problem. If you vaccinate, there could be a problem. And you want to make sure that you are as solid on that decision, because if the adverse event were to happen, you're going to have a huge emotional hangover. And once that cloud passes, I want to make sure that the parent is standing on very solid ground. And if you're a parent, you know that you do the best you can every day, and sometime in the future, you might learn some new information, but at that time, you can't beat yourself up for that information you didn't have at the time, and you did the best you could at the time. So
I want to throw in a wrinkle on what you just said. You mentioned polio. There hasn't been a natural case of polio in decades here in the U.S. My father contracted polio after World War II, and he has semi-paralysis in his right hand today around his thumb, so he can't actually use his thumb to grip strong things like tools. But he survived. There has been an explosion in measles in the United States, which was extinct. It was eradicated. How it was eradicated, a lot of people have different views. Some people say it was vaccines. Other people say it was sanitation. Who knows? But it was eradicated. It's come back. Although the news rarely reports this because it counters the narrative that our borders are closed and everyone that comes into the country is a good, clean, well-earning citizen. It appears that illegal immigration is the primary driver of the measles outbreaks here in the U.S. And there's a lot of other diseases that are now coming back. Treatment-resistant tuberculosis is another one that we didn't have until a few years ago, and it's mostly illegal immigration that's causing that. Given that we have diseases now that we probably didn't really need to be vaccinated for until recently at all, because they didn't exist, and they've recurred, not all of them life-threatening. Measles is not life-threatening. A lot of people had it and survived in this, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Has that changed your view at all, or would you still give the same advice to parents that there really isn't too much to be concerned about other than life-threatening illnesses, even the ones that have now, you know, kind of crossed our borders and are now coming back? And I'm not challenging you at all. I'm actually asking you because I'm curious. I don't really know how I would feel about it. And I don't treat children for infectious disease. I just treat them for psychiatric illness. So it's something that's come up in my head recently. And I don't really know how to advise parents on that. What's your take on that?
I've been asked that question about the measles outbreak recently, and I went back and looked at the CDC data for the last 10 years, and the occurrence of measles yearly is anywhere in the 50s to the low 100s over the past 10 years. So some years are in the 20s, there was a couple of years of 108, if I remember the number correctly. So this year, this 2024, since we've been receiving some news about the measles outbreak, I want to say that there were about 35 cases towards January 29th, or maybe that was February 29th. I don't remember which of those 2 days, but not any. And it was definitely fewer than the number of total cases that happened in the last couple of years. So that discussion of the measles outbreak is more media sensation than reflected in the numbers over the last 10 years.
I agree with you, Brian. And then, you know, you mentioned the car crash analogy. And by the way, I like your categorization. I think it allows parents or the lay public to really understand the risks involved. And I like that. I may steal it from you or borrow it from you.
Yeah, no,
I'll give you credit. You mentioned car crashes, and I think you said the DTaP. DTaP, of course, is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. The problem is tetanus doesn't exist. Like, you could Google the number of tetanus cases a year in the United States. I think it's 2. So it's an extraordinarily rare condition. And the challenge too is you can't buy these vaccines individually, which I think is a huge mistake. And then you also have to look at, this is what I do anyways, as I educate patients. I'm going to alter it now because I love how you do it. I literally break out the package insert, and I've got one here. This is for MMR. You can't see it if you're listening, but I'm holding it up on the camera that we're all viewing. And it's like, literally, I think it's about 8-point font. So you almost have to put on giant reader glasses to even see what it says. So I show the package insert, and I show 3 things. One, what are the studies that brought the product to market? And interestingly, oftentimes, there were never placebo-controlled studies that were done. The vaccine was either compared against another vaccine or an older version of the vaccine, but rarely are there actually randomized controlled blinded placebo studies. So I point that out, if that's the case. The second, and I think this is very important, is what are the post-marketing studies? It's one thing when you have controlled trials with, you know, 8 or 10 or 15,000 people, and you have researchers and they gather the data and this, that, and the other. But until a vaccine has actually been road tested and now given out to a population, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, we don't actually know how it's going to perform in a side effect standpoint. And the example I like to give is the old Pinto car. Great car, compact, inexpensive, lots of people were buying it. Looked kind of funky, but everybody was driving one until they got rear-ended and then they exploded. And so they had to be pulled from the market. You know, the testing and the manufacturing seemed to suggest that this was a solid car, economical, cool looking, et cetera. But when it was actually road tested and thousands of people started to drive the thing, they discovered that there was a flaw in how it was manufactured. And very similar with all these vaccines, the FDA requires in the package insert a section called, I can't remember, I'll find it and give you the exact name, but it's, you know, post-marketing studies. What is the data after it's actually being used that is being reported? And these are often side effects that are far different and far greater than the ones that actually were in the controlled studies. And then finally, what the hell is actually in the product that you're injecting directly into your body? It's not just the vaccine. It's often an adjuvant, frequently aluminum, which is a neurotoxin. It's often a preservative, like in the flu shot this year, the preservative is formaldehyde. And there's also other products in it, surfactants, and this janky stuff called polysorbate 80. And if you were just to Google what is polysorbate 80, you realize it's not good for your body. It potentially could be a carcinogen. It could potentially disrupt your gut biome, disrupt the gut permeability. And so these are the things that I want parents to know, and then they can make an informed decision. And I honestly don't think there is a single vaccine that is currently on the market that I can recommend. If a parent, after doing their own research, wants it, sure, we carry them in the office. Please read the package insert. Please let me know that you've had informed consent. Then by all means, if that's what you need to do and that's what you want, that's fine. I just don't think these vaccines are safe or effective. I'm actually writing a book with a friend of mine called Unavoidably Unsafe, Revisiting the Childhood Vaccine Schedule. And it's going to shed light on all these things that I'm describing. So the MMR vaccine, for example, relatively benign, I guess. But what most people don't know, and it's hidden in plain sight because they use abbreviations, is these are live viruses, live attenuated. The virus is, you know, altered so it doesn't actually infect you, but it's a live virus. And oh, by the way, they were originally grown in aborted fetal cells. You don't know that unless you know how to read these package inserts, because they use these abbreviations, don't completely describe what it is, and you have to look these things up. But in California, by the way, Brian, even though the MMR originated in aborted fetal cells, there's no religious exemption that is allowed. Now, there's a lawsuit going on. Del Bigtree and his ICANN, Informed Consent Action Network, and others are now suing the state of California to try to overturn that fact that you can't claim a religious exemption. But I imagine it's going to take years and eventually, you know, go up to the Supreme Court where they rule. But almost every other state that I'm aware of has religious, personal, and in many cases, medical exemptions. But I just don't think these things are safe enough or effective enough. And the fact that the companies that make them have no liability, it just gives me pause. If I had to do it all over again, I might, and I had little kids, I don't. But if I did, I don't think they'd receive a single vaccine. And I realize this is controversial. And I know I'm called crazy names. I'm called a quack, an anti-vaxxer, et cetera. And quite frankly, I don't even care anymore. I'm just going to tell the truth as I see it and let parents make an informed decision based on the data that's available to them.
This episode is brought to you by Rogers Hood Apothecary.
Here are seven signs you may have a parasite. My biggest issue, because I did have parasites, was teeth grinding, skin irritation, and unexplained digestive issues. The other indication that you could have a parasite is eating after 7 p.m. and craving sugar. My name is Kim. I'm the Worm Queen and the inventor of the Parify Kit. Let's go over it. Parify, it's your parasite cleanse. Sustain, it's your candida and your bad bacteria cleanse. Metal Flush, it's your heavy metal detox. Cinnabon, it's your binder. The kit comes with instructions. We have a nut-free option. We ship worldwide. The Parify Kit is for ages 3 and up. Use IDM as your 10% discount code. Find it on rogershood.com.
So that's my rant.
That's a very good rant. I definitely appreciate a lot of that. So just to hit on some of the points that you just mentioned, the DTaP shots, that's been around since the 40s, but it's always been in a combination. It's been a DTP since it first came out. Then they changed it to DTaP. So unfortunately, when we look at this as a car crash, you know, you can't separate these out. the MMR, once they become 1 year old, then that is available on the vaccine schedule. And I'd also put that in the car crash area. And you may recall that you could get the MMR split until about 2007, 2008. And then they stopped the split vaccines. Here in Florida, we can use the religious exemption as well as a medical exemption. Interesting, in our part of the state, the religious exemption is not accepted by the Diocese of Venice, which my town is in, which is quite a shock, as the origin of the vaccine is from aborted fetal cells. And obviously the Catholics have a very strong opinion on abortion, but the bishop in this area will not accept that for any of the parochial schools. And additionally, all of the Jewish schools in my town, at least, I can't speak outside of my area here in Southwest Florida, but they also will not accept the religious exemption. So I thought that was an interesting turning your back on religious freedoms by the Catholic group and the Jewish people here in my part of the country. What else did you just touched on? Telling the parents about the vaccine insert. You know, one of the areas of that insert that I always touch on is section 13.1, which states this vaccine has not been tested for impairment of fertility, carcinogenesis, or mutagenesis, if I recall those three areas correctly.
That's right. It's right here. 13.1. This is the MMR package insert. Vaccine has not been evaluated for carcinogenic or mutagenic potential or impairment of fertility.
Right.
Why would you want to put that kind of product in your body? You don't know if it's going to cause cancer.
And you'd mentioned the adjuvants. And the adjuvants, what I explained to my parents what adjuvants are, and to kind of highlight this section 13.1, I said, so these vaccines, the ingredients that we're trying to administer to the child or the adult is grown in a biological agent. This could be an aborted fetal cell. It could be in horse serum. It could be in monkey kidneys. It could be in chicken embryos. Because in order to grow the virus or the bacteria, there has to be some kind of biological agent that it's grown in. And then when that agent that we're trying to extract out is grown in sufficient quantities, then it's extracted. And in that extraction process, chemicals are used. So that's where the formaldehyde comes in. That's where the polysorbate 80 comes in. And they said, so in order to make your product more effective, they add in an adjuvant. And I said, to explain the difference between the vaccine part that we're looking to inject into the child for the immunological response versus the adjuvant, if I'm having a dinner party at my house and my four-year-old child walks into the dining room, living room, where we have 50 adults standing having a cocktail party and dinner party, you know, they're not going to see the four-year-old walking in, except maybe the few people that are right there. And that's the vaccine being injected into the child's body without an adjuvant. You know, the local area will recognize that there's an infection or part of an infection, an attenuated infection, and it will make a localized response. But that's a poor use of the vaccine component that we're trying to get into the kids. This is how the pharmaceutical company, probably the CDC, is thinking. So they want to add on an amplifier, something that'll speak louder. So if that child then re-enters the party on the back of an 800-pound gorilla, then everybody in that party is going to turn and look at that door as that kid's walking through the door. And that gorilla is the adjuvant. So that gorilla, when it's injected, or the adjuvant that's injected like aluminum or with MF59, I think it's called, another adjuvant, very powerful adjuvant. And what that does is it uncouples the TH1 and TH2 side. And I know that's very scientific, but we're born with an innate immunity, and then we have to acquire an immunity. And what the adjuvant does is it causes the part that we're supposed to acquire to not be as robust, and the part that we are innate with to overactivate. And so we get a further separation that would have happened naturally. And we know that one of those sides is that TH1, TH2, one of the sides, TH1, is associated with increased cancer. So they're not going to study it because one of the ingredients can lead to cancer. So why would we study it? So that's why that's put in there. Plus with these the preservatives, we don't know what that's doing to, you know, these young babies that still have, you know, they still haven't made their, you know, their sperm or their eggs completely yet. So, you know, there's a lot of damage that could happen there. And as we saw with the COVID vaccine, a lot of, you know, in that vaccine particularly, it went to the ovaries, went to the hormone glands.
So another Dr. Thornburg analogy, I love it. I'm going to be stealing that one too on the adjuvants. That is great. You need to come out with like a book of Thornburg memes, because it's It's quite brilliant. It's
great... I've been lecturing since 2006 on this. I have like a 3 to 4 hour lecture on this. And I mean, super deep. I mean, it goes from philosophy and quantum physics all the way to the practicality to David Kessler saying only 1 to 10% of vaccine adverse events are actually recorded. Then you have the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, which I think is, well, that's when I worked there up in Washington, D.C., that's what it was called. Now it's called AHQR. And they're the brainiacs that determine healthcare policy. And they're actually good guys because they're just really trying to find out what's the best for the population. And they recommended that the EHR programs, electronic medical record programs, should have a button for recording or submitting adverse events. And it would be that simple then to improve what is widely regarded as a failure of the reporting system. And it would be embedded right into the EHR, but of course, no EHR, the CDC, nobody's backed that idea, even though it has been published widely by the AHQR that it should be incorporated in.
Now, do you have a YouTube channel?
I do. It's very fledgling, though. My Instagram seems to have hit.
I'd love to hear this lecture that you give on the philosophy of vaccinations and so forth. It sounds fantastic.
I need to put it up there. I haven't done it since before COVID, but I need to get back on that.
So if somebody wants to find you and follow you, I see you on Instagram as Dr. Dr. Thornburg on Instagram. Is that right?
That's right.
Dr. Thornburg Wellness, actually, on Instagram. And you've got a line of supplements that you have as well. And do you get any pushback from your colleagues about your stance on vaccinations?
I do quite a bit. Well, I shouldn't say quite a bit. I'm the guy in town that the OBs and the pediatricians know if the parent says, hey, we don't want to vaccinate, then they'll say, well, then Dr. Thornburg is the person that you should see. So they move patients in my direction. They're holding their area. Yeah, I have another little meme, if you want to call it that. And when parents say, well, why isn't my pediatrician, if they're transferring practices because that parent woke up and wanted to slow down or stop giving vaccines to their child, say, well, why didn't my previous pediatrician do that? Why don't they understand this? And I said, well, when we're trained, you know, to get to medical school, you have to give the right answer. And then when you get, you don't want to be called out and singled out for not knowing the right answers. You're tired, you're exhausted. There's so much to know. You want to be approved. You want to go through the system. So there's a certain militaristic approach to medical education that you got to give the right answer in order to move ahead. And so then when you get to residency program, at least when I trained, you know, we didn't have the hours that they have now. So you would be up for quite a long time. And then in my training program, we would have to have morning report. And if you were the senior resident, you had to sit before the whole department, and any of the tough cases you were reviewed. And of course it went up a line, starting with the medical student, then the intern up to me to answer for what we had done overnight. And there's no room for alternative thinking in those spaces. So you come out very much holding the perspective that, you know, vaccines are good, or this medicine is the one that we should be using, or this is the approach that we do to this disease. And with that sleep deprivation, the need to perform, the need to give the right answer, the need to advance, you that could arguably be called brainwashing. You have to give the right answer. You're sleep deprived and you're mocked if you don't give the right answer. So pediatricians come out with this kind of perspective, and I came out with the same way. I'm not going to take patients who don't vaccinate. And then if you're in a traditional practice and you're seeing, you know, 40 kids a day on average, then it's hard to run a practice and have different rooms on different vaccine schedules. It's here in Florida. You know, if I was allowing that to happen in a busy traditional insurance driven practice where I'm doing anywhere from 35 to 45 kids a day, it would be hard to run different rooms with different vaccine schedules. Somebody's going to get the wrong vaccine or not get the right vaccine, and that would be a problem. And so here in Florida, if I have 3 lawsuits against me and they're successful, meaning that I'm found guilty, and that arguably if you're giving the wrong vaccines to the wrong people, that could be a big problem. Why am I going to jeopardize, you know, my income, my family's future for somebody who just walked in my practice who says that they don't want to vaccinate? And the only time I have with them as a pediatrician is maybe 10 minutes of quality time to do my history, my physical, give anticipatory guidance, answer their questions. And then if this did go sideways and we gave the wrong vaccine or didn't give a vaccine that we should have, and now I'm on a stand and their attorney's grilling me, he's going to say, so Dr. Thornburg, in 10 minutes, you were able to do a full H&P and advise these parents on a complex topic like vaccines at a way that they would be able to adequately make an informed decision? No, I'd get blown out of the water. So In the traditional model, you just can't practice like that. No,
right.
I'm a concierge physician, functional physician, where I spend an hour with each physical. So the whole structure is different. So when I explain this to the parents, why their previous pediatrician probably wasn't listening to them, I explained the training, the business model, and it's somewhat of a self-preservation that those doctors are following. And, you know, obviously it's not running. It's not working out with a lot of these parents who are waking up and starting to ask some very good questions.
Well, you give those unwoke doctors a lot of grace. But Mark, Brian talks about brainwashing with a combination of being overtired, overstressed, overworked, and under fear. It sounds a lot like what happened during COVID, where the vast majority of physicians recommended the COVID vaccine and masking and testing, et cetera.
I was just discussing this issue of brainwashing yesterday with an economist who studies the effects of social pressure on economic decisions. And I think it applies to medicine as well. You have physicians who were taught, as you just described, Brian, to give the correct answer. When they're in medical school, and thus to give the correct, so-called correct advice to their patients. And when you're under pressure, like all doctors were in 2020, 2021, 2022, the risk, just emotionally, much less financially and legally, to giving the so-called wrong answer, meaning the answer that's not the typical answer, the one that you're being told to give, even if it's correct, actually correct, is so great that most people just don't want to be bothered. Even though they may have doubts, because it sets them apart. And being set apart as a physician, it does not lead to good things. We learned that in medical school. You don't want to be the outlier. You want to be dead center, because everyone is protecting you on both sides. The people that are the outliers, they don't get commendations. They get suspensions. They get surveillance. They get academic probation. They get pressure placed on them to toe the line. So medicine is, unfortunately, because it's so important, it's unfortunately not a profession that attracts or sustains courage and courageous people. We don't have a lot of courageous physicians. They are really outliers. I wish that weren't the case, but unfortunately, most physicians are just as, if not more, susceptible to brainwashing than the average non-physician professional. And that is, I think, one of the weaknesses of our occupation.
Oh, it is exactly. I mean, and unfortunately, you know, we most people go to medical school at a very young age, and we even have baby docs who go in after 2 years of college, and there's not a lot of life experience that's happening at that point. And maybe this contributed to my evolution, and maybe it didn't. But I mean, I went back later. I was a philosophy major, and then I went back at the age of 25 to do my pre-meds. So I had some work experience and some life experience. But as I mentioned, I was already viewing health from a much more holistic perspective from a young age. But having that time in outside of medicine definitely helped me become stronger in my perspectives as I moved through the system, because I was 5 or 6 years older than everybody else. And to mention one of these stories about the training, the brainwashing, I was a third year medical student. I was on my surgical rotation, and we had a radiology round. So it was all the radiology residents, all the surgical residents. And I was the only medical student in the room. So of course the picking, what do we call it? The
pimping.
The pimping started right with me. And, you know, they're just asking me questions. It was my first rotation third year. So it was right out of my second year. And I was like, didn't know the answer. And I just, you know, my face is just turning red and I'm just getting hot. And the next question just looks at me and next question just looks at me. And then you kept going up the line until somebody answered it. And then the next week when we came in for radiology rounds, he said, "So who's the youngest doctor?" "Oh, it's Dr. Thornburg. You're going to bring, you brought so much honor to your family last week. We're good to have you back this week."
that's what we had to endure. And we learn to give the right answer, even if we have doubts about that answer, but we know that's what they want to hear. And you do that over and over and over again for 4 years of medical school, and then, you know, 3 to 5 years of residency, and you get conditioned to do that. And then you start doing that to patients as well.
Yeah.
So it's crazy.
You stop thinking. I mean, you really do. And you're tired. I mean, even in regular practice, it's not just residents that are tired. If I'm doing 40 kids on average a day in the office, and I'm also doing some hospital rounds early in the morning, I mean, you're exhausted by the time. Your brain's fried. And so you want to keep people in the middle of the road as possible so you don't have to spend extra time. And it's just human nature. We're just not designed to handle complex patients or outside. And maybe that's not a full statement. We're definitely trained to deal with complex patients. But I mean, when we're moving through the office practice, it's hard to find time to adequately serve somebody who has a more complex issue as your charts are backing up. That would be a much better
way to create that. So Dr. Brian Thornburg, a board certified pediatrician out of Florida, Instagram, Dr. Thornburg Wellness. He's got a very robust site, tons of reels that you can scroll through about everything from vaccine to eczema to various pediatric conditions. It's a wonderful resource. What's your advice to, as we wrap up here, what's your advice to a mom who's pregnant and trying to figure out her path forward after she delivers?
One of the questions I get a lot on my website, on the Instagram site, is, you know, how can I find a doctor that's going to listen to me and make me a partner in the health of my child? And I, unfortunately, I have to tell them to go to lay midwives and ask them who in their community is working more naturally, because obviously the lay midwives will already be aware of what the environment's like and who's practicing how. And if they don't have anyone in their environment or in their community that's like that, then I just tell the parents to educate themselves as much. I tell them to listen to Robert Kennedy on Joe Rogan. He did a great breakdown on the history of vaccines. I tell them there's a lot of books out there. You know, we look at Sherry Tenpenny and Russell Blaylock, and now direct them so they can have a greater awareness of what it takes to truly be informed on such a complex decision.
Yeah, that's good advice, going through a midwife. That's great advice, actually. So I've learned a lot from you, and I'm going to use some of your analogies. I think they're fantastic. So Dr. Thornburg, thank you so much for coming on Informed Dissent. We'll have to do this again soon.
Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate the guidance that you're giving everyone out there.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Informed Dissent with Dr. Jeff Barkey, board-certified primary care physician, and Dr. Mark McDonald, board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. Informed Dissent, the intersection of healthcare and politics.